Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound.
I mean, the problems that we're seeing in America didn't start in 2015 when Donald Trump descended the escalator. They were here hundreds of years beforehand. We haven't dealt with stuff. And so because we haven't dealt with stuff, and oftentimes we like to put Band-Aids on tumors, right? We're still dealing with those effects.
That is Andra Gillespie, director of the James Weldon Johnson Institute for the Study of Race and Difference at Emory University in Atlanta. Gillespie writes and teaches about race in American politics. As you can imagine, in these past 4 years, she's been busy. We talked about the transition from the Trump administration to the Biden administration, including the new vice president, Kamala Harris, and what she might mean for Black Americans, the South, and the nation as a whole. Gillespie gives blunt advice on how Republicans can get more of the Black vote. And we talk about whether Trump's 4 years were a fever or maybe something more lasting. Here's our conversation. This podcast, this episode, is going to run on Inauguration Day. We're taping it a few days in advance. I want to know what your hopes, your fears, your thoughts are about what these few days before, during, and after the inauguration of Joe Biden as president are going to be like.
Well, it's tense, and you know, the tension hasn't abated from the Capitol siege. Our country is still polarized. Our leaders are still polarized. You know, there still isn't a consensus yet on, how to respond to the tragic event. So, you know, even if I think a majority of people agree that that shouldn't have happened, right? People are still debating, you know, how much President Trump should be held responsible for it. And there is a lot of disagreement about what to do to remedy it. I still see people playing, political points and jockeying for position based on what happened. Even after the riot, right, you still had a critical mass of members of Congress who, you know, objected on record to the results of the Electoral College. We still have people who are touting the idea that the 2020 election was fraudulent. And so what that means is that there's still going to be a lot of people walking around who view President Biden as illegitimate, not because, right, they just don't like him, but because like they have been led to believe and have not been disabused of the fact that widespread election fraud took place. And so I think we still have a really long way to go. I've debated with folks online about whether or not we should liken this to some type of viral event or whether we should liken it to cancer, because I think both are apt. So, you know, in some ways, we could argue that the fever hasn't broken yet.
So I want to go look at a little bit kind of the roots of this fury that led to the siege of the Capitol. And it's, you know, been evident at least for the past 4 years, if not longer. And, there are lots of arguments and debates about where all this came from. And some of it is that, you know, Trump sort of tapped into this, these people who maybe have lost jobs and are worried about their future. And he spoke to that in a way that other people haven't. And I think there's another more sort of simpler argument that this is just angry white people who see that their hold on the country is slipping away. Do you have an opinion on sort of where you fall in that spectrum?
I don't want to give Donald Trump credit for creating this problem. Donald Trump deserves credit for exacerbating a problem. And I think making it okay to say and do things that are shouldn't be socially acceptable. But he is a symptom of a larger problem that's long existed in the United States. And I do think that a lot of this goes back to America's original sin of race. And forthcoming work that, you know, I've written about, I've certainly looked at the role that racial resentment and nostalgia certainly play. And that taps into other concepts that political scientists talk about, like a perceived loss of social dominance. and other types of factors. But yeah, I mean, we do know that high white identifiers would be more likely to, you know, support Donald Trump.
I want to go back. You mentioned nostalgia in there somewhere early in that answer. And I'm wondering what you think those folks who have that nostalgia, like, what are they nostalgic for? Is it the Reagan era? Is it 50 years ago? Is it 150 years ago? What is that? What kind of nostalgia do you think we're talking about here?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, it's a somewhat of an amorphous concept. And the way that I measured it when I was looking at this was asking people questions in 2016 about whether or not they thought America was better off 8 years before or 50 years prior. And so we can't figure out from survey questions always like what was their nostalgia trigger per se. But we could look at the 8 years prior as a juxtaposition to the Obama administration. So basically, do you think America was better off, you know, before Obama took office than after he took office? And so some of that is racialized as well, right? That some of this might be a backlash towards President Obama. But I mean, it could also be other types of questions, like if you just disagree with his policies. So that's a more classic retrospective kind of question. You know, it's more of the classic sort of Bill Clinton versus George H.W. Bush rendering, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago type of question. The 50 years ago mark does carry us back into the 1960s at the time that I was asking the question. And, you know, it's a rough 50 years, right? There were changes that were being ushered in American society in 1966, which would be the precise 50-year reference point. We don't think that people necessarily think in that kind of way, but that sort of gets you to a sort of earlier period in an earlier era where, you know, the things that we know about American society at the time were that, you know, it was white dominated, that it was male dominated, and that there might be people who are longing to go back to that particular era where the country made sense. And it made sense because there were clear social hierarchies that put certain people on top.
So in the midst of all this turmoil in the last couple of weeks, Georgia elected two Democratic senators for the first time, basically since Southern Democrats were Republicans, really. You were in Georgia, been in Georgia, kind of watching all this happen, probably getting a lot of flyers in the mail. What's your feeling on what happened there?
So I think this ushers in a new era of contestation in Georgia politics. So as you mentioned before, Democrats dominated the state, and then most of the white Democrats became Republicans. And so that's how Georgia got to be such a predominantly Republican state. That's not what's happening. So white voters are still Republicans in the state. But what's happened is the non-white population has grown. And so as the non-white population has grown and it breaks Democratic, numerically, it's starting to come into, you know, play. It's starting to come into a position where it can successfully challenge Republicans for power. And the trajectory suggested that a breakthrough Democratic victory was imminent. It wasn't clear that it was going to happen in 2020. You know, it could have happened in 2022 or 2024, but the margins had been narrowing in statewide elections. So, you know, Stacey Abrams came within a percentage point and a half of beating Brian Kemp in 2018. So long as the population numbers started to favor Democrats a little bit more, and as Democrats perfected their get out the vote operation, it wasn't going to be inconceivable that another candidate running in statewide office could narrow that gap and perhaps even surpass Republicans. So that's part of what's going on. Georgia, kind of like North Carolina, but unlike South Carolina or Alabama or Mississippi, while, you know, the vast majority of white voters in the state identify and vote as Republicans, there are enough white Democrats in the state that if they turn out to vote and you get robust turnout amongst Black populations and in the 2020 election cycle, also amongst Asian American and Hispanic voters, right, there's an opportunity to get a numerical majority of the vote in this particular case. So yeah, we're talking about the potential to get, you know, more than 25% of whites voting Democratic. The number that they always go for is 30% of white voters voting Democratic in the state. And Joe Biden hit that number. So that's part of the reason why he won.
And I know you talked about this coalition being more difficult in places like South Carolina and Alabama. But in the long term, are the demographic trends going that way? I mean, are we going to see in the next 20 years what happened in Georgia this year happening in some of those places?
I think the place where you should go look is Texas, right? Texas is, you know, has a majority minority population. It has, you know, a Latino population that is more likely to be Republican in some parts of it, which is why Republicans are still highly competitive in the state. But it's got a large enough sort of Democratic minority population that Democrats are going to be more, are going to contend more easily. And so what you should be paying attention to are the margins by which Republicans win. And so as if those margins are shrinking, then what you're likely going to see is a point at which if Democrats organize, they're going to be in contention to be able to win offices that they haven't been winning in the last couple of decades. You know, I think that Alabama and Mississippi and South Carolina are a little farther behind. They're farther behind because the white Republican voting bloc is more cohesive. And they're also farther behind because you don't have the same level of growth in the Asian American and Hispanic population in the state that's going to break Democratic.
At this point, especially given the last 4 years, what can any GOP politician do to go after the black vote? Is there anything that somebody could say or do, given sort of the current context, that would make a difference?
So yeah, it's called apologize and repent. So, you know, we could talk about the debates sort of and outreach that, you know, that the Republican Party or that Donald Trump did in African-American communities and what might have been effective. And I do want to acknowledge the exit polls that show that, you know, Donald Trump increased his vote share amongst Blacks, particularly amongst Black men, and then try to qualify that a little bit. So I'm not pretending that that stuff didn't happen. But in general, the reason why Blacks are 90% Democratic in their voting behavior and why that did not change in the 2020 election cycle is because of a perceptual advantage that the Democratic Party has on issues related to race. And it's a perceptual advantage that they have enjoyed for over 50 years now. So Democrats started to woo African-Americans with the New Deal. And so we started to see Blacks be very strongly Democratic in their voting behavior in the 1930s and 40s and 50s. So, you know, Blacks were Democrats by like a 2-to-1 margin. But Republicans were still able to retain a sizable share of the African-American vote on the basis of civil rights. So the Democratic Party, you know, was the party of the New Deal, but it was also the party of Southern segregationists. And there were Blacks, particularly middle-class Blacks, who were very leery of the Democratic Party for that reason. That starts to change, you know, in 1964. So when Barry Goldwater is the Republican nominee for president and he votes against the Civil Rights Act, that was a non-starter for most African Americans. And we saw that 20 to 30 percentage point share of African American voters that Republicans enjoyed in previous elections go down to under 10%. Richard Nixon and Gerry Ford did a little bit better in the 1970s, but the general rule of thumb is that Republicans get about 10%, give or take a couple of points, in presidential elections. And that's because the Democratic Party is viewed as the party of civil rights. And the Republican Party is the party, you know, first of Barry Goldwater, then of Nixon's Southern strategy, despite other things that he may have done policy-wise that were intended as overtures towards African-American communities. It's the party of Ronald Reagan, you know, giving a states' rights campaign speech in around Philadelphia, Mississippi, where Goodwin Schwerner and Cheney were murdered. You know, it is the party of Willie Horton, and now it is the party of Donald Trump making excuses for white supremacists and telling congresswomen of color to go back where they came from. most African-American voters are skeptical of the Republican Party because they've seen, collectively speaking, 50 years of racist overtures. They know that the Southern segregationists who were, you know, once Democrats, changed their party ID and their voting behavior to the Republican Party. And they find that, you know, inexcusable, and it's going to make it really hard to credibly reach out. We're also doing this in an environment of toxic polarization. People are talking about, you know, the fear of division and disunity, you know, in this, sometimes referencing Russia, but they aren't actually, you know, asking for any, they're not asking for the president or for even themselves to be held accountable for their divisive rhetoric. And so it almost seems like people are trying to get reconciliation on the cheap with this one without having to admit fault, because it would seem to, for some, to be a fate worse than death to have to admit that a Democrat was right on this particular issue. That doesn't mean you have to become a Democrat or that you're gonna all of a sudden start co-sponsoring bills with your Democratic counterparts. But in all honesty, right, I mean, some people just didn't seem like they were actually willing to concede that Joe Biden really won the election, and that Donald Trump, you know, caused a riot that was actually intended to overthrow their job as a co-equal branch of government, because they didn't want to give Democrats the satisfaction of being right on one particular point. And we've got to ask ourselves, like, how we lower, and that's, this is for everybody, how do we lower the temperature so that people can, you know, concede, you know, being right or being wrong on some points without feeling that they have to give up their entire identity. And if people are that wedded to their identity, then there has to be some personal reflection that says, what's wrong with this, like, level of pride that I can't admit that I'm wrong about anything? Like, that's just arrogance to the 10th degree, and it's destroying our country.
When we come back, Andra Gillespie talks about how the politics of the Trump era have made it hard on families and friendships, even her own.
I've had to learn how to extend grace to people. I've sometimes had to learn how to check myself. I've not done this perfectly.
That and more ahead on Southbound. I want to pause for a second to let you know about another Southern podcast I really enjoy. It's called The Reckon Interview, and is produced by our friends at AL.com, the leading media voice in Alabama. John Hammondtree and his fellow hosts dig deep on issues such as how the South created modern politics and the power of college football in the South. If you go back in their archives, you'll even find an interview with me back in there. I highly recommend the Reckon Interview for anyone who wants to understand the South better. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Now, back to our conversation with Andra Gillespie. So I know one of the things you study is sort of Black political leadership over time. So Kamala Harris is now the first Black woman to, she basically has the highest office anybody, any Black woman has ever reached. What does she mean in that sort of historical context, and what does it mean for her to be there?
Well, it means a number of different things. I mean, aside from being the first Black woman, she's the first woman to hold this position. And I think that that's actually really significant. When we think about sort of the context of feminism, I think we thought that it was going to be a white baby boomer who was going to break the glass ceilings, right? We could look at Hillary Clinton, who fits that mold to a T. There are some people who might have wanted Elizabeth Warren to do that. And the fact that it's a, you know, an African American and South Asian American woman who, by being born in 1965, makes her just a Gen Xer, right? Sort of, it kind of shatters our notion of what feminism looks like. And so I think that there is sort of an interesting kind of symbolic commentary on second wave feminism that's there. That second wave feminism kind of got folks to the edge of the promised land, but it's likely going to be younger, more diverse women who are going to sort of bring women into the full fore in terms of leadership. If we think about, you know, some of the opposition that Vice President-elect Harris faced when, you know, she was being considered for vice president. Some of that opposition, I think, was rooted in a type of intersectional racism where people were really having a hard time accepting the fact that by becoming vice president of the United States, she ends up in, a very, very strong position to be the face of the Democratic Party going forward and to be the potential successor in terms of being the next Democratic nominee for president. That's not guaranteed, but being vice president certainly puts you in a better position than anybody else. And I think, you know, what we saw was people kind of working out their sort of wrapping their head around the fact that it wasn't going to be the archetype that people thought it was going to be. So I think that's symbolically important. The challenge that she's going to face, you know, are one, coming in after an administration that basically had a scorched earth policy about just about everything and having to help rebuild that. But she's also going to have to constantly work on sort of brokering trust between the many different communities that she, you know, sits between. And so, you know, her role is probably going to be a bridge builder. And it's a question of whether or not she would use those bridge building skills to address really pertinent issues. So in particular, you know, one place where, you know, I'm curious to see what her issue portfolio was going to look like as vice president. Joe Biden had one, so I expect he's going to give her one, too, so that she has a place where she can shine from a policy standpoint is, you know, potentially with policing. And this was a point of contention with Black activists who look view her with suspicion because she started her career off as a prosecutor. But it also gives her a certain cachet to be able to sit down with other folks and to bring people to the table and to have a discussion. I think the hard part is that as part of our polarized politics, people are not accustomed, don't want to necessarily sit down and compromise, necessarily want to forge changes that could be viewed as incremental. But that's structurally how our government is set up. And so she's going to have to bring people to the table and appear to be an honest enough broker that she can tell Black Lives Matter activists, okay, you're not going to get this, but how about this? And then to tell, you know, police officers, okay, you're not going to get that, but how about this? And see if she can bring people together and make people feel good, right? Because we're at a moment where there are a lot of people who are very zero sum about this. And it's in part, and understandably so, right? Because they view the questions at stake as being existential to them.
You know, so many of us have had these last 4 years sort of family fissures, friends fallout over Trump and his policies and whether you follow them or not. I'm just wondering whether in your group of friends, family, whatever, if you've had any fallout from all this.
So I do come from a politically heterogeneous family. So, you know, while 90% of African-Americans vote Democratic. And I think that there are a lot of African-American families where, you know, everybody is a Democrat. I actually come from a family that's mixed. And so I think that in part fuels my research interest in African-American Republicans, because this is something that I experience and I witness in my own family. And so, yeah, I mean, we don't all agree in my family. And there have been some interesting conversations, you know, in the past 4 years and certainly, you know, in the last few months about the election. And I've had to learn how to extend grace to people. I've sometimes had to learn how to check myself. I've not done this perfectly. Right. I think some of the frustration is the contestation over facts, because I think that that's the part that's most disheartening about this. This isn't just a disagreement on perspective when we can't actually all agree on the same facts, like coronavirus kills people. I actually haven't been part of that conversation. I just have heard about it. You know, the election wasn't stolen. Right? Because like this voter fraud that Donald Trump keeps on talking about is made up. Right? Like that makes it more difficult to have a conversation. And I think it also lends oneself to wanting to call somebody stupid because you love them and you kind of want to shake them into reality. But that's not always the most effective way. And so you have to learn when to speak up and when it's probably better to keep your mouth shut. While it breaks my heart when I hear about stories of people not speaking to relatives anymore over political issues, you know, I sometimes understand why that could happen, but I also make a conscious choice that I'm not going to stop speaking to family members because of political disagreements. And so you just have to figure out a way to respectfully kind of, you know, share your point of view, point people in different directions, and see if they would be willing to, you know, change their political point of view. And if they don't, to know that your love is still unconditional for them. And so, you know, perhaps, you know, in my family, nobody's going to estrange themselves from anybody over this. And so maybe that's part of the saving grace. But yeah, I mean, I found myself being like really affected by people who I love sometimes saying stuff where I'm just like, I can't believe that you possibly like think that. And like, also, I know you. I know you're smart. You know better than that. And figuring out how to disagree respectfully. And lovingly is a challenge. And I think we just need to acknowledge that, but we still need to do the hard work of doing that.
I want to close by kind of going back to something you said at the very beginning, that you and some of your colleagues have been debating basically whether this is, these last few years, are a virus or a cancer. Is it something temporary that sort of goes away and you're not really the worst for wear, or is it a long-term malignancy, basically? And I guess the question I have for you is, which way are you leaning?
So I still use virus often, but it's a cancer, right? I mean, the problems that we're seeing in America didn't start in 2015 when Donald Trump descended the escalator. They were here hundreds of years beforehand. We haven't dealt with stuff. And so because we haven't dealt with stuff, and oftentimes we like to put Band-Aids on tumors, right, we're still dealing with those effects. And so it's going to take something invasive and at this point painful, because we haven't dealt with it before, in order to be able to deal with the problem. And I still see a resistance to wanting to address these issues, a resistance to addressing the polarization, a resistance to addressing sort of the subtext and sort of, you know, pretext of race in American life. And as long as we are unwilling to deal with that, we're going to be walking around with, you know, something that's going to metastasize into something awful.
The way Andra Gillespie frames it, a virus or a cancer, the implication is clear. In this country, we're living through a sickness. And like with any sickness, sometimes you can get through the day-to-day just fine. Good enough that you might even forget you're sick. But it's important not to forget. We can't let the last 4 years and the building wave that led to them just drift away into bygones. There has to be some accounting, some sort of reckoning, telling the truth and naming names. As a doctor will always tell you, even when you start to feel better, take all your medicine to the end. We have to swallow hard and force it down. That's the only way to completely get healthy again. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode is show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.